It gives me great pleasure to again welcome Noam Chomsky to Georgetown. To those of you who will meet Professor Chomsky for the first time this evening, let me introduce him to you very briefly. Noam Chomsky was born on December 7, 1928 in Philadelphia. His undergraduate and graduate years were spent at the University of Pennsylvania, where he received his PhD in linguistics in 1955. He joined the staff of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1955, and in 1961 was appointed full professor in the Department of Modern Languages and Linguistics, now the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy. During the years 1958 to 1959, Chomsky was in residence at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, New Jersey. In the spring of 1969, he delivered the John Locke Lectures at Oxford. In January 1970, he delivered the Bertrand Russell Memorial Lectures at Cambridge University. In 1972, he delivered the Nehru Memorial Lecture in New Delhi. And in 1977, the Huizinga Lecture in Leiden. Professor Chomsky has received honorary degrees from the University of London, the University of Chicago, Loyola University of Chicago, Swarthmore College, Delhi University, Bard College, the University of Massachusetts, and the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of books and articles on linguistics, philosophy, intellectual history, and contemporary issues. His works include Aspects of the Theory of Syntax, Cartesian Linguistics, Sound Pattern of English with Maurice Hall, Language and Mind, At War with Asia, American Power and the New Mandarins, Problems of Knowledge and Freedom, For Reason of State, Peace in the Middle East, Reflections on Language, Essays on Form and Interpretation, and Representation. The Political Economy of Human Rights, Volume 1 and 2, with E.S. Herman. Rules and Representations. Lectures on Government and Binding, Toward a New Cold War, Radical Priorities, Some Concepts and Consequences of the Theory of Government and Binding, The Fateful Triangle, the U.S., Israel, and the Palestinians, and Manufacturing Consent. Knowledge of Language, Its Nature, Origin, and Use is forthcoming. Freud once observed that the voice of intellect is a soft voice, but it does not rest till it gained a hearing. Well, Noam Chomsky's voice is soft, but it is one that carries very far. Over the years, this voice has never rested and has gained the kind of hearing across America few critical voices have been able to achieve. That despite perhaps the most persistent suppression a leading intellectual has ever been subjected to in this country. This is because Chomsky, and I'm going to use a word he doesn't like very much, is perhaps the most effective deconstructionist of the myths and ideologies of the ruling and corporate elite. Certainly, no critic, in my view, has so ruthlessly uncovered the goals and workings of the foreign policy establishment or unmasked the cynicism of its intellectual ideologists. Asked in the marvelous interview, which is part one of the Chomsky Reader, which is available outside, what the true responsibility of intellectuals might be, Chomsky's reply was that the first duty of the intellectual is to tell the truth. And the way Chomsky tells the truth, and here lies his shattering impact, is fully, uncompromisingly, with relentless logic and total factual command, as you will now see. Professor Chomsky.
There is a standard view about democratic societies and the role of the media within them. It's expressed, for example, by Supreme Court Justice Powell when he spoke of the crucial role of the media in affecting the societal purpose of the First Amendment, namely enabling the public to assert meaningful control over the political process. That kind of formulation expresses the understanding that democracy requires free access to information and ideas and opinion, the same conceptions hold not only with regard to the media, but with regard to educational institutions, publishing, the intellectual community generally. Well, all of that seems kind of obvious, in fact, almost tautological. It's therefore worth bearing in mind that there is, in fact, a contrary view. And it's the one that inspires the title of this talk. The contrary view traces back to the origins of modern democracy, in fact, much earlier, but certainly to the origins of modern democracy in the English Revolution of the 17th century. Now, at that time, educated commentators were becoming quite concerned about the radical agitators with their little printing presses all over the place, who were making people so curious and arrogant that they will never find humility enough to submit to a civil rule, quoting one of them. John Locke held that ordinary people must be told what to believe. The greatest part, he said, cannot know, and therefore they must believe. Now, underlying these doctrines, which were very widely held, is a certain conception of democracy. It's a game for elites. It's not for the ignorant masses who have to be marginalized, diverted, and controlled, of course, for their own good. Now, in modern times, this contrary view about the intellectual life and the media and so on, this contrary view, in fact, is the standard one, I think, apart from rhetorical flourishes. It runs right through the American Revolution and up till the present. The revered and moralist and influential political commentator Reinhold Niebuhr explained that, I'm quoting him, rationality belongs to the cool observers, but it lies beyond the ordinary person because of the stupidity of the average man. So the average man follows not reason but faith, and he must be provided with necessary illusions and emotionally potent oversimplifications. The dean of American journalists, Walter Lippmann, expressed the same view when, a few years earlier, he had written about what he called the manufacture of consent, that is, what is called agitprop in communist propaganda. He said that these new methods of manufacture of consent were leading to a revolution in the practice of democracy, which is a good thing, because policy issues are too complicated for the ordinary person and have to be managed by what Lippmann called a specialized class, that is, Niebuhr's cool observers. And in fact, similar ideas are quite common across the spectrum in academic scholarship, in the public relations industry, in political circles, and elsewhere. To mention just one last case, huge literature on this, the influential American political scientist Harold Lasswell held that because of the ignorance and stupidity of the masses, we need a whole new technique of control, largely through propaganda. And this is particularly critical, he said, when the state lacks power to coerce by violence. If the state can control people by violence, you don't have to worry so much about propaganda and thought control. But when the state loses the capacity to control by violence, then it's necessary to control what people think, because what they think may eventuate in action. And you can't control the action, so you've got to control it at the source. So from this point of view, far from thought control being inconsistent with democracy, it's the very essence of democracy. And in fact, that is the common conclusion outside of rhetoric. Now, according to that quite widespread elite conception, which is probably dominant among those who think about the matter, the media do have a societal purpose, but it's not the societal purpose described by Justice Powell. Rather, the societal purpose of the media, and the same would hold then of the educational institutions and publishing and so on, the societal purpose would be to serve as propaganda agencies for the specialized class, the cool observers, us smart guys, who achieve this status either because we already hold a share of private power or because we're able to serve private power. That was a point that was expressed by one of your local boys, Henry Kissinger, in one of his academic essays back in the late 60s. In one of his more lucid moments, of which there are not very many, I should say, in which he explained what an expert is. He said that a person becomes an expert by having the capacity to articulate the consensus of people with power. That's what makes you an expert. And that's essentially correct. Generally, these truisms about social life and about political life and about the intellectual vocation remain unspoken in a properly functioning propaganda system. We are no longer back in the honest days when Harold Lasswell, for example, spoke openly about the need for propaganda. That was in the early 1930s. Or when the founding fathers explained that those who own the country ought to govern it. That's a moral injunction that was instituted in practice, and in fact is the dominant theme of American political history. Well, according to this conception, the media ought to follow what my colleague Edward Herman and I call a propaganda model in a recent book. They ought to, if they do their job, they ought to present a picture of the world that conforms to the interests of power and privilege. And they ought to provide the public with Niebuhr's necessary illusions to keep the ordinary person on course. Now, to eliminate confusion, all of this has nothing to do with liberal or conservative bias. According to the propaganda model, both liberal and conservative wings of the media, whatever those terms are supposed to mean, fall within the same framework of assumptions. And in fact, the liberals, if you think it through, play a particularly critical role in a well-functioning propaganda system. They define the presuppositions. They determine the limits that you can't transgress. And that's quite important. A well-functioning propaganda system doesn't express its doctrines. It just assumes them. That puts them beyond the limits of discussion and thought. So, for example, in the case of Central America, it's a presupposition of discussion today that there are four democracies, maybe flawed democracies, there are four democracies with elected presidents, and there's one Marxist-Leninist dictatorship which never had an election that meets our high standards, and it had better live up to its promises to do so. And what follows at that point depends on whether you're a liberal or a conservative. But unless you go that far, you're just not part of the discussion. You haven't accepted the presuppositions at all, and you don't qualify as an objective reporter. Now, the common presupposition that's common to liberals and conservatives happens to be false, indeed absurd, but that's irrelevant. It's a necessary illusion, and therefore it is near unanimous, probably actually unanimous, in the media. I can't even think of a counterexample, and haven't found one in years. Well, let me take another case. Last week, a Salvadoran judge dismissed charges against military officers who were accused of running a kidnapping ring. Now, you can imagine three different ways of reporting this. First way of reporting it would be apologetics, either deny that it happened or say that it's the right thing or something like that. That's the kind of reporting you might find in a totalitarian state. The second way of reporting it is what you find in the liberal press. So here's Lindsey Grusin in the New York Times. He describes this as a setback to U.S. efforts, quoting, "The United States has sought to strengthen the judicial system as part of its effort to build democracy in El Salvador." So it's a setback, and since we're an honest liberal press, we recognize that. Well, there's a third way of reporting it, which would be to write that it's a setback to U.S. efforts to improve the image of the military regime that the United States established to bar the threat of democracy. That is, it's a setback to the efforts to ensure that Congress will provide the funds to destroy the people's organizations fighting to defend their fundamental human rights and to protect the privilege. I'm quoting Archbishop Romero shortly before he was assassinated by these security forces. That would be the third way of describing it. Now, the first way, the totalitarian way, is not very effective. Everybody's going to see through it. The second way, the liberal way, is very effective. In fact, it becomes the very framework of thinkable thought and the basis for objective reporting that the United States is trying to build democracy but is having a hard time. The third way of describing it is not to be found. The Archbishop's perception was very plausible when it was expressed, and it is by now overwhelmingly obvious by those who choose to see, but you can't find it anywhere. And that's important. Beyond that, there's a very rich historical and documentary record that explains why the U.S. government systematically follows this path. There are variations, doubtless. Fear and hatred of democracy reached a kind of peak, kind of pathological extreme during the Reagan administration, and that also went along with an unusual degree of enthusiasm for the resort to violence to conduct a war of extermination and genocide against a defenseless civilian population. I'm now quoting the successor of the assassinated Archbishop Romero, Archbishop Rivera y Damas. You'd have to search the archives of states that we'd rather not refer to find a major journal calling for sending arms to acknowledged killers and torturers, quote, regardless of how many are murdered, quoting the New Republic, or to find a public official who at the peak of the war of extermination and genocide against the defenseless civilian population could say, I think it's a terrible injustice to the government and the military when you suggest that they are somehow responsible for terrorism and assassination, and who praised the moral quality of those who were conducting the atrocities that by that time had amounted to Pol Pot-style levels, or who's capable of saying that Sandinista abuses against the Miskitos were more massive than any other human rights violations that I'm aware of in Central America. This At that time, Sandinista atrocities against the Miskitos possibly amounted to a few dozen people in comparison with what Jean Kirkpatrick, who I'm quoting, was well aware of tens of thousands of people tortured and slaughtered and mutilated and raped in a war of extermination and genocide against defenseless civilian population. But the point is, you can say those things and you can be accepted as long as you keep to the proper conditions. The United States is trying to defend democracy, though maybe failing. Well, returning to Lindsey Grusin and the liberal press, the fact that the United States was committed to destroying the threat of democracy by a war of extermination and genocide if necessary, that's undiscussable, it's unthinkable. In a well-functioning propaganda system, it's the task of the official, respectable dissidents to bar entry to such thoughts by defining the limits of criticism, by saying, thus far and no further. And that is the job of the liberal critics, and that's why a well-functioning propaganda system would in fact have a liberal bias, as the conservatives complain. Notice further the functional utility of the idea that the media are adversarial and confrontational, that they have a liberal bias, that they're suspicious of power and critical of it. In short, there's a value to the idea that the media play what the New York Times yesterday called their traditional Jeffersonian role of opposing government, or as Jefferson himself would have put it, opposing concentrations of power altogether, including private power. Well, let's go back to the general, more or less, consensus. There is a major component, certainly, of modern thought, modern liberal thought, that advocates that the media follow a propaganda model for the good of everyone, as I've indicated. And there's, independently of this elite advocacy, there's good reason to expect, on quite uncontroversial assumptions, that the media would follow that course. Just consider the national media, the sort of agenda-setting media, like the New York Times and the Washington Post and the major television channels, which set the framework that everyone else more or less adheres to. They are, first of all, major corporations, huge corporations, in fact, tied up with even bigger conglomerates. Like other corporations, they sell something to a buyer. The buyer in this case is advertisers, that is other businesses, and the thing they sell is folks like you. They sell audiences. And for the elite media, they try to sell privileged audiences. First of all, they raise advertising rates, and secondly, they're the ones who you're really trying to indoctrinate. For most of the population, the point is just to divert them, get them to think about something else, because they're the stupid and ignorant masses. But for the subpart that's possibly politically active and articulate, you really need indoctrination. So what we have is major corporations selling privileged audiences to other businesses. It would hardly be a surprise, given that, if the picture of the world that they construct reflects the interests and concerns of the sellers, the buyers, and the product, and in fact also the interests of the ideological managers who themselves are privileged elites with moving into the same circles, up and back from government and business, and so on. Take a closer look, you find there are many other factors that press in the same direction, without going into it. On quite uncontroversial, basically, free market assumptions, you would expect the propaganda model to be valid. So two points. One, a propaganda model of the media is advocated by liberal analysts. They think that's the way the media ought to behave. Secondly, you'd sort of expect that without any controversial ideas, just looking at the institutional structure of the media. A third point to bear in mind is that the public generally agrees with this analysis. The public regards the media as too conformist, too easily influenced by the powerful, as a sheep in wolf's clothing, as one recent poll revealed. So we have three comments about the propaganda model to start with. First of all, it is advocated by elites as the way the media ought to behave. Second, it has a kind of prior plausibility on uncontroversial assumptions. And three, it's generally accepted by the public. Now, those three points don't prove that it's valid, of course. Prove that it's valid, you've got to check the facts. But they do suggest, something. They suggest that it ought to be part of the debate over the media, given that it's advocated by elites, that has prior plausibility, that the public believes it's true. You'd assume that it would at least be part of the discussion. Well, it isn't. There is a debate over the media, but it's over a different question. The debate is over whether the media are too adversarial. Do they go too far in their defiance of authority? Quite excluded is the possibility that the opposite is true. And notice that that is also predicted by the propaganda model. The propaganda model itself is dysfunctional. It is very useful to believe that the media go too far. Because if you believe that the media go too far, that means the assumptions that they accept are the outer limit of thought. If they go too far when they say the United States is failing to establish democracy, is a setback to U.S. efforts to establish democracy, but when they go too far in saying there's four elected presidents and maybe it's a little bit flawed and one totalitarian dictatorship, then plainly we can go no further. It can't go further than what's too far. And also, the media don't mind that image themselves. They don't mind the criticism that says you guys are too adversarial. You're pursuing your Jeffersonian role too vigorously. On the other hand, the idea that the media conform to the propaganda model is not particularly flattering, and it may make the people so curious and so arrogant that they will never find humility enough to submit to a civil rule. To quote again my 17th century source. Well, let me stop a little on this point. This particular prediction, unless there is a particular prediction of the propaganda model, one prediction is can't possibly be taken seriously. Incidentally, the model has a rather disconcerting feature if you think through its logic. Plainly, the propaganda model is either valid or invalid, obviously. If it's invalid, we can dismiss it. If it's valid, we must dismiss it because it's dysfunctional and disruptive of power. And that particular conclusion of the propaganda model, namely that it must be excluded from discussion despite its obvious plausibility and elite advocacy, that prediction is very well confirmed. And that's a very enlightening fact if you think about it, because the model is indeed initially plausible and, in fact, is very well confirmed. Well, let me give you one example. A study of media conflicts in Lebanon in Central America is published by the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University, hit it by accident. I have a detailed analysis of this in a forthcoming book, which has the same title as this talk. It's one of the most extensive and detailed studies of media coverage of third world conflicts in existence with plenty of people participating. And the contents are quite interesting and, in fact, remarkable, but I'll put them aside. You can look at the book if you're interested. Let me just keep to the framework of discussion here. Now, there are two sections. There's one section on Central America, and there's another section on Lebanon, primarily on the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. It's about 1984 when these seminars took place. In each case, two halves of the book, in each case, the agenda for discussion is set by people who condemn the media for their alleged anti-U.S. and anti-Israel bias. So each discussion is introduced by an extreme hawk taking that position. Then the discussion rages between those who condemn the media as too adversarial and those who defend the media as dispassionate and objective and fair-minded. Notice that that's exactly as the propaganda model predicts. In fact, surprisingly, we hardly even find the kind of statistical error that one would expect in a complex real-world situation that you find in the natural sciences, for example. Here we get adherence to the ideal system, not the complex real system. For example, in the case of Central America, it is literally 100% conformity to that framework. That is, not one phrase departing from that framework. And that's pretty remarkable, because the media coverage of Central America is almost a textbook illustration of conformity to power, of the propaganda model, has been overwhelmingly documented. But there's not one phrase in the discussion even suggesting that possibility. Now, that level of conformity to power and ideological doctrine far surpasses the predictions of a propaganda model. In the case of the Israel-Lebanon part, we do find statistical error. There's about 95% conformity. The other 5% is devoted to charges of a pro-Israel bias, which are raised but then never discussed. They're raised and forgotten. The discussion is only about the other things. In fact, that means that they're recognized to be just noise in the system, in the technical sense of noise in the system. And again, that's pretty remarkable, because pro-Israel bias in the media is so extreme as to have reached almost comical levels. Can you think of any other country that's described, I'll quote a few phrases, as the symbol of human decency, as a country that cares for human life, as a country with unique high moral purpose? I'm quoting from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Time magazine. Each of these quotes happens to be taken from one of the periods when atrocities reached such a peak that they were actually reported. But there's not a hint of any of this here. There's not a hint of this here apart from the noise in the system. That's, again, kind of intriguing. Notice that's a very strong confirmation of the propaganda model in one of its second-level predictions. Now, the editor of this volume, and it's an interesting volume, I urge you to read it, Landrum Bolling, he does observe the following. He says, "We had very little representation in the meetings," this is the introduction, "we had very little representation in the meetings of Arabs and pro-Arabs who feel and have long felt that U.S. media coverage of the Middle East is basically blatantly pro-Israel and that Arabs and their interests are, and viewpoints are constantly denigrated." It's an interesting comment. Read the crucial part again. He said, "We have very little representation from Arabs and pro-Arabs who feel that the media are biased towards Israel." Now, he doesn't explain why only Arabs and pro-Arabs could draw that conclusion from investigation of the media. The tacit assumption that he's making is that people have passions, but not reasons, no thoughts. Now, that assumption is not only remarkable, but it's also manifestly untrue. The contention that the U.S. media are heavily biased in favor of Israel is perfectly familiar among American and European and Israeli commentators who are neither Arab nor pro-Arab and who are in many cases extremely critical of the Arab states and the PLO, even people who are bitterly denounced in the Journal of Palestine Studies, for example. In fact, you're listening to one of them. But Bolling does not indicate, he doesn't indicate what efforts were made to obtain views that depart from the framework of the seminars. But I think in this case you can make the safe assumption that the selection he has there is a pretty fair sample of intellectual opinion. Let me stress again the remarkable character of the view that only if you're an Arab or a pro-Arab could you have that thought, whatever pro-Arab is supposed to mean. Well, there's a real issue here. Apart from, let's get back to the real issue. The real issue is whether the major predictions of the propaganda model are confirmed empirically. Does the press actually confirm it? Does it conform to this prediction? Well, by now there's thousands of pages of detailed documentation in print which test this model in every conceivable way. There's more coming out. There's also, as far as I'm aware, no sensible challenge to it. I think, in fact, it's one of the best confirmed theses of the social sciences. But in accord with its predictions, it's off the agenda. And if it's valid, it must remain off the agenda. Notice that's part of its logic. Well, the right thing to do now would be to go on to give examples, and that would require a course, not a lecture. In fact, it would be kind of misleading to do it here. It's misleading to give a few illustrations. It's misleading because you might quite plausibly conclude, and you would be right to conclude, that they maybe take, maybe that's an exception, or how do you know it's systematic, and so on. You really have to see the whole picture to be convinced. And in fact, you find that the picture is quite uniform. As I say, there are thousands of pages of documentation, and they test the thing in every way anybody's been able to think of. I'm going to keep to one case. One case which is longstanding, current as well. It's evolving, and it's very important. In fact, it may lead to global destruction, as it's threatened to do several times in the past. And that one case that I'm going to talk about is coverage of the U.S.-Israel-Arab interactions, U.S.-Israel-Palestinian interactions. And I'm going to talk partly about what I think is going on, and partly about the way the media are covering it. and let me urge you to check what I'm saying. Don't take my word for it. It's not very hard. Information's there. Check the documentation for yourself and see if this picture is accurate or inaccurate. I think if you take a... I'll tell you what I think you're going to find. A close look will, I think, reveal the effectiveness and significance of regular and persistent media distortion and the consequences of that. That's what I think the picture shows. Well, let's begin recently. Let's begin with last December. Last December, on December 14th, to be precise, there took place what the media uniformly describe as a stunning breakthrough, a triumph of U.S. diplomacy. What happened is that the United States finally forced the ambiguous Yasser Arafat to accept American terms. This was a seismic shift in attitude in the PLO, which proves that the U.S. should hang tough, as the Washington Post editors put it. That's a lesson to other third world upstarts as well. All of these are quotes from the major media, and you could go on, this huge collection of them. That's the standard story. Well, the result of this Palestinian capitulation to American firmness is that the United States agreed to conduct a dialogue with the PLO, which is another stunning breakthrough. That's what one reads across the political spectrum in the media and also across the spectrum of political discussion, extending from the ultra-right wing to, say, groups like Peace Now in Israel and others. Now, in fact, this entire picture is completely false in every detail, but it is a necessary illusion, and therefore it is accepted without qualification and without deviation. Let's take a look at the events and the history that led up to them, now comparing the completely irrelevant reality with the necessary illusions that have been very carefully crafted over the years and that are being crafted again once again today. It's a very revealing story. Well, let's begin with the famous dialogue. You recall what happened on December 14th, according to the standard version. Yasser Arafat, in a press conference, said the magic words that the State Department had written for him for many years after having refused to do it, as trying to squirm out of it all those years. He finally capitulated and said them, and the United States then agreed to a dialogue. What's going on with regard to the dialogue, the famous dialogue between the United States and the PLO? Well, let me contrast two views about this matter. One of them, I'll start, is the standard view in the American press, and so as to not to load the dice unfairly, I'll pick the most extreme skeptic in the American press, at least the most extreme dissident and skeptic that I know of, namely Anthony Lewis. In the New York Times, happened to be yesterday, something called a memo to the PLO. And in the memo to the PLO, Lewis urges the Palestinians not to reject Yitzhak Shamir's proposals, just made in Washington, as incidentally they're doing with virtual unanimity. And why should the Palestinians not reject Shamir's proposals? Reason? Because the U.S. government, Lewis assures the Palestinians, the U.S. government regards Palestinian positions with sympathy, understands them, and is generally supportive of them. So they should count on the good faith of Washington to push things forward. Apparently that's what the historical record is supposed to tell us. And the proof of this that he mentions is the dialogue that the United States is conducting with the PLO over Israeli objections. Surely if anything proves U.S. sympathy with the Palestinians in good faith, that's it. So therefore they should accept Shamir's proposals. Well, that's the extreme skepticism and dissidence in the American press. Let me take something now from the Israeli press. It happens to be from a right-wing journal, mainstream, mass circulation journal by a very good journalist, Nachum Barnea, who's quite dovish, rather sportive. He's now happy in their lot. And it describes a meeting that took place between Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin of the Labor Party and five leaders of Peace Now. And he describes how Rabin walked into the meeting very cheerful and relaxed and happy, looking a lot different than he had done, say, 6 months ago when he was sort of, tense and nervous and upset, virtually ready to make a V sign, Barnea says. And then he explains to the Peace Now leaders that he's particularly happy about the dialogue between the United States and the PLO. He says that's a successful operation. It's a very low-level discussion. And what it amounts to is that the United States is giving Israel a year, he says a year at least, to crush the Intifada by force. The purpose of this dialogue, he says, is to deflect the diplomatic pressures that were building up through last year and give Israel now, they got a year's grace, so the year at least of grace. And he goes on to say that in this period, he says, we are increasing the military and economic pressures in the territories. And he says they will be broken and they will accept Israeli terms. So the U.S. maneuvers are a delaying effort to allow Israel to increase the pressure so that the people there will be broken. The Peace Now participants in this meeting raise some objections. They're not convinced that the harsh economic and military pressures will work. If there are some other objections, they're not indicated here. Well, that's two views about what the dialogue is about. One of them, the first one, is the universal view in the American press. The second one is the view of the Israeli defense minister expressed in the Israeli press. And I think there's pretty good reason to suppose that Yitzhak Rabin knows what he's talking about with regard to the function of the dialogue. Notice there's another question. There is a tactical debate between Rabin and the Peace Now leaders as to whether violence will work. That's another issue which I won't address here. I'm talking about the nature of the dialogue. Well, let's pursue it further. The dialogue at that time had one meeting. There was one meeting between the U.S. ambassador in Tunis and the PLO representatives. The contents of that meeting were leaked by the PLO, presumably, and published in the Egyptian press, the press that was close to Mubarak, and they were picked up, presumably, by Israeli intelligence, translated, and reprinted in the Jerusalem Post, which means they are known to every reporter, because they appeared in English in the Jerusalem Post in January 6th. The Jerusalem Post was very upbeat about it. They were very happy. They said the protocols, they printed the protocols of the dialogue. They said this shows that the United States is taking the Israeli position all the way through, and they're very pleased about that. The U.S. ambassador began the dialogue by announcing two conditions. Condition number one is no international conference. Condition number two, I'll read you the actual words of the U.S. ambassador, with regard to the Intifada, the uprising, the U.S. position is that undoubtedly the internal struggles we are now witnessing in the occupied territories aim to undermine the security and stability of the State of Israel, and we therefore demand cessation of these riots, which we view as terrorist acts against Israel. That's underlined, but italicized by the Jerusalem Post. This is especially true as we know you are directing from outside the territories these riots, which are sometimes very violent. Now, those are the two U.S. positions. Let me parenthetically remark that it's entirely conceivable that U.S. intelligence and also Israeli intelligence actually believe that the PLO is directing the Intifada from outside. There's anybody who's bothered to look at the intelligence record, whether it's the CIA or the FBI or Mossad or anything else, will understand the absolute incapacity of intelligence of any state, whether it's the National Political Police or Secret Service or whatever, their total incapacity to comprehend the reality of popular struggles. The point is, the idea is just too threatening, can't be faced, can't be comprehended. And it's also necessary to bear in mind the ideological fanaticism that colors intelligence reports quite typically. Every intelligence agency I've ever seen, and also the higher level interpretations of them. There's a lot of mythology about intelligence, and it's quickly dissipated if you take the trouble to read the declassified documents. So it's quite possible that U.S. intelligence actually believes what the ambassador is saying, despite its manifest absurdity. Well, what's the meaning of these two U.S. proposed demands? Demand number one, that there be no international conference. Well, the meaning of that's obvious. The point is, the whole world outside of Israel and the United States is in favor of a diplomatic settlement. So therefore, if there is an international conference, it's just going to mean bringing people, somebody in who's going to put pressure on for a diplomatic settlement. And therefore, there can't be a diplomatic international conference because the United States is opposed to a diplomatic settlement. That's the only meaning of that, of any of that. Now, in what the United States proposes, that is direct negotiations between Israel and the PLO, even if Israel will be willing to accept the farce, in such negotiations, there's no pressures at all. And therefore, Israel can say, get lost if they want, and that's the end of the negotiations. But if you have an international conference, it's a problem, because the rest of the world is all interested in a settlement. You won't be able to do that. So no international conference. That's point one. What about point two? Call off this terrorism against the state of Israel in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Well, there, the U.S. position is quite straightforward. If the Intifada is brought to a halt, then matters will revert to the situation that prevailed before. And at that time, the United States cheerfully supported and lavishly funded Israel's occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and its regular repression and humiliation of the Palestinian population and its steps towards integration of those territories within Israel. And meanwhile, the media praised the benign occupation and hailed the occupiers as a society in which moral sensitivity is a principle of political life. I'm quoting the New York Times right after the Sabra Shatila massacres. And that's what we'll go back to if the Intifada is called off. Well, that's the meaning of the two U.S. proposals, and therefore I guess it's kind of understandable that they were never mentioned or printed in the U.S. press, to my knowledge. I've never seen a single reference to them, although they're certainly there, and everybody certainly knew about them because everyone reads the Jerusalem Post. Well, notice that that tends rather strongly to support Yitzhak Rabin's conclusion. I won't go on to more details, but there's plenty more to support it as well. Well, let's turn back to December 1988, when Arafat finally capitulated to his stern mentors in Washington, and he said the magic words, agreeing to the long-standing U.S. demands and this stunning triumph of American diplomacy, as the press puts it. Notice that up until December 14th, including the editorials that appeared on that day, up until December 14th, the editorials and news columns, the media were uniformly condemning Arafat for his ambiguity, for repeating the old Arafat hedges, as the New York Times put it. And on December 15th, the next day, in fact on the evening of December 14th, everything was different. Arafat had capitulated in this December 14th press conference in Geneva, and while we still naturally have to be wary, at least there's some progress. That's the story. So how do we know that Arafat capitulated on December 14th? Well, that's easy. George Shultz appeared on television and in his lugubrious voice announced that Arafat had capitulated. So that fixes those facts. Therefore it is so, and the media snapped to attention like a trained dog on command. Now, an inquiry lasting about 2 minutes would have sufficed to show that at the famous press conference, Arafat's words remained as far from the U.S. demands as they had ever been, and those differences are quite substantive. If Arafat had capitulated and had said the magic words, then the Palestinians would have abandoned everything, which is exactly why the U.S. government and the media now insist that that is what has happened. That means in the world of necessary illusion, the one that works, they have abandoned everything. If they ever make any demands again, that shows they're backing off on their promises, which we've invented for them. That was what an inquiry of 2 minutes would have shown. An inquiry of 20 minutes, maybe, would have shown that Arafat basically repeated positions that he had stated, sometimes more clearly and explicitly, for the past 13 years. But throughout this period, and still today, Washington has rejected that position. In December, for reasons to which I'll return in a moment, Washington decided to say that Arafat had capitulated, so therefore he had, in the world of necessary illusion. Come back to the facts in a moment. Let me just mention to you something I heard last night from an overseas phone call from a well-known American correspondent in the television media. He told me an interesting story. He had read an article in which I write up this stuff, and he told me that I'm not trying to check this yet, but he told me that the television stations on the evening of December 14th did not run slots from Geneva. You know, usually what happens is a television reporter reports something and makes a little 90 seconds that they send over the satellite, and that's what you see on the 77 o'clock news. According to what he told me, that didn't happen in that case. Rather, there were live discussions between New York, or wherever they are, New York, I guess, and the reporters, you know, Peter Jennings and Barry Dunsmore and so on, in which they discussed it. And he said the reason is that when the reporters went to the press conference, they didn't hear anything different than before. They knew Arafat just repeated what he'd always said for years, and it was just as far from the U.S. demands as ever, so they put together these little brief nothing statements and were getting ready to send them across on the satellite when they were informed from New York by telephone that the State Department had announced that things were different than what they had seen, and therefore they should kill those stories. And since there was no time to make up news stories and send them across, they would have to just be interviewed live. Well, I heard that from a rather well-placed television source, and as I say, I haven't been able to check it, but a nice research project for somebody. Well, let's proceed. I'll come back to what actually happened at that famous discussion of Arafat's, but let's first put it into a little bit of background, because that's the only way you can understand what's happened. So if you bear with me for a minute, I'll mention a little bit of the relevant history. I'm just going to look at the diplomacy after the 1967 war. Bigger story than that, but for reasons of time, let's stay there. Well, there's an official story about this. The official story about the diplomacy since the 1967 war is, first, the United States has been pursuing the peace process. Now, notice there's a comment to make here. Notice that that's not a fact, that's a tautology. There's a tautology because the word peace process has a very special meaning in U.S. political discourse. You look it up in the dictionary and it means process leading for peace, but that's not the way the word is used. Like most terms of political discourse, it really has two meanings. One, the actual meaning, and the other, the meaning that's used for ideological warfare. Now, the actual meaning of the word peace process is process aiming towards peace. The ideological meaning, and the one that's universally used in the media and in scholarship, is that the peace process refers to whatever the United States happens to be doing at the moment. Now, that's a useful meaning. Check this out, if you like. It follows that it's impossible to find a phrase like the United States is undermining the peace process, because that's not only false, it's self-contradictory, you know. So therefore, there's no point in saying it. And notice that you can reach that conclusion without having to bother with the ugly, complicated world of fact where you have to look at documents or anything like that. You just know it's true by definition. You know, like 2 plus 2 equals 4. I mean, it doesn't take any work to figure it out. So it's very convenient usage. Actually, I mentioned this fact in a talk at the University of Washington in Seattle a couple of months ago, and there happens to be a very good media project there. And somebody in the media project wrote me a letter a couple of weeks later saying that he'd done a computer check and through the New York Times from 1980 through whatever that was, January 1989, picking out the phrase peace process, and he'd found, I think it was 850 articles referring to peace process, and there wasn't one in which the United States was in any way opposed to the peace process. Notice, again, we don't even get statistical error if this is correct. That's pretty remarkable, because during the 80s, the United States was deeply committed to undermining and blocking the peace process in Central America and in the Middle East, to mention just two. But if this brief data analysis is correct, there's one statement to that effect, and I'd predict that you won't find it in the scholarly literature either. So the United States, for point number one, the United States has been pursuing the peace process, but that's tautology. Now, point number two, what about the Arabs? Well, official line is the Arabs have been opposed to peace. They've been committed solely to the destruction of Israel, although there was a break. In 1977, President Sadat of Egypt understood his evil ways, and he broke ranks, and he became a man of peace. And now, in December 1988, maybe Arafat has made his first halting moves to follow Sadat in that direction. But apart from that, and of course, you know, our friends, Hussein and so on, apart from that, the Arabs all are opposed to peace and just want to murder Jews and so on and so forth. With regard to Israel, the official line is that the Israeli Labor Party, which ruled the country up till 77, followed a policy of what the New York Times calls healthy pragmatism, and still does, but the Likud, the other major political grouping, especially under Yitzhak Shamir, is kind of recalcitrant. Continuing with the story, under Labor, and still today, because of their healthy pragmatism, Israel makes forthcoming offers, proposes a fair, peaceful settlement, but the Arabs always refuse. Now, that's the official line, endlessly repeated, I mean, over and over again. Well, let's break the rules and turn to the irrelevant reality. Here we have a return to the documentary record, and let me urge you to look at it. First, we'll begin with Israel. There happens to be, as far as I know, only one detailed diplomatic record of particularly the Labor Party. It includes the years 66-7 to 77, written by a top-level Labor Party functionary, Yossi Bailin. It's in Hebrew, but very, you know, Hebrew, and nobody can translate it. It's worth reading. It's a detailed, almost day-to-day record of cabinet meetings of the Labor government. The basic principle to which it keeps is stated by current President Chaim Herzog, who's a dove, and it says the Palestinians cannot be participants in any way in a land that has been consecrated to our people for thousands of years. Land includes the occupied territories. And it pretty well keeps to that. Now, if you look, you discover that Israel has made two diplomatic initiatives during this period when it was governed by healthy pragmatism and none since. Under Labor, the first diplomatic initiative was in June 19, 1967. June 19th, so it's a couple weeks after the war. There was a split cabinet vote, 11 to 10, and its split vote was sent to the United States privately, and that's the first initiative. That proposed, tentatively, a settlement with Syria and Egypt, but with Israel keeping the Gaza Strip and the no mention at all of the West Bank. So no settlement with Jordan. Israel keeps the Gaza Strip, tacitly assumed keeps the West Bank, but makes a settlement with Syria and Egypt apart from that. Abba Eban, again noted diplomat and dove, describes this as the most dramatic initiative in Israel's history before or since. Well, that dramatic initiative lasted, which notice means they keep the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, that was replaced in August 1968 by another proposal, what's called the Alon Plan, which is the official Labor Party position up till the present. And up till recently, that has meant Israel keeps the Gaza Strip and the Golan Heights, and in those days, much of the Sinai. And with regard to the West Bank, it keeps about 40% of it, about what it needs. Essentially keeps everything except the areas of heavy concentration of Arab population. Problem is what they call the demographic problem, too many Arabs in a Jewish state. So Israel, the idea is Israel should keep the resources, keep the territories it needs, keep access to the water and keep the markets, keep the labor force, but not have to administer the population. That's the healthy pragmatism that the New York Times advocates. Those are the only two proposals in reality. Now, turning to the Arabs, starting in, things started to shift in the late 60s, but let's take February 1971, not 77, February 1971. February 1971, President Sadat of Egypt, newly had just become president, made a offered a full peace treaty to Israel, full peace treaty, no reservations, on the internationally recognized borders, meaning pre-June 67 borders, with all the structure of UN 242, guarantees, right to live in peace, etc., full access to the canal, the straits, etc., and offering nothing to the Palestinians. Palestinians aren't even mentioned except as refugees. It's in accordance with UN 242. In fact, Sadat's proposal of February 71 was virtually identical to official U.S. policy, as expressed by Secretary of State William Rogers in the Rogers Plan shortly before. A couple of weeks later, Jordan made a similar proposal. Israel responded to Sadat's proposal. It accepted it officially as a genuine peace offer and refused it. In internal discussion, we read that they refused it because they felt if they held out, they could get a better territorial settlement. In the United States, there was a split symbolized by Rogers and Kissinger, but each representing major interests and conceptions. The split was over whether to accept the diplomatic settlement now offered fully by Egypt in terms of official U.S. policy, or whether to reject it. Kissinger's approach, as he explains in his memoirs, was to push for what he called stalemate, meaning keeping things frozen. And since then, he won out in the internal bureaucratic conflict, and since then, stalemate has prevailed and still does. Well, that was February 1971, I stress, not 77, not when Sadat flew to Israel, and made a less forthcoming offer than in February 1971, because in his 77 proposal in Jerusalem, which established him as an official man of peace, he expressed what by then was the general international consensus that there should be a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. I'll come back in a moment to why the second one is permitted to enter history. The reason why the first one is not permitted to enter history is obvious. It tells the wrong story. It says the United States was opposed to the peace process, and since that's a logical contradiction, it must be that the events didn't happen. So therefore, they never mention, except in a footnote in some arcane monograph somewhere, and they didn't happen for this perfectly obvious reason. Well, that was February 71. Let's move on to January 1976. In January 1976, the UN Security Council debated a resolution calling for a full-scale political settlement on the internationally recognized pre-June 67 borders, with recognition of the rights of all states in the region, their right to live in peace and security, territorial guarantees, security guarantees, in fact, all the wording of UN 242, explicitly, verbatim, not paraphrases, but verbatim, and the Palestinians, but now UN 242 extended in terms of the broad international consensus of the mid-70s to include a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Notice that that resolution incorporates UN 242, but now extends it to include a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The UN 242 was a resolution, we talked about a settlement among states. It was totally rejectionist, offered nothing to the Palestinians. Well, that was January 1976. Who was for it? Well, the resolution was introduced by Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, the three confrontation states. It was openly backed by the PLO, publicly and openly backed by the PLO. In fact, according to Chaim Herzog, now president, then UN representative for ambassador for Israel, according to him, it was prepared by the PLO. There we can just take Israel's word for it. But the fact that they supported it is not anybody's word. That's on the public record. You can read it in the New York Times. The United States vetoed the resolution, so it's down the memory hole. Can't exist, because if it exists, it shows the United States was blocking the peace process, which is a logical contradiction, so therefore it doesn't exist either. And in fact, when you look at reports of the peace process, books about the peace process, you know, articles by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times about the peace process, these things aren't there, because they don't exist. They can't. Logical contradiction. In fact, from 1976, there have been repeated offers. I'm not going to run through the details. There have been repeated initiatives from the Arab states, from Arafat, from the PLO, calling for negotiations leading to mutual recognition. It's all down the memory hole. Sometimes they were vague, sometimes they were explicit. It's all down the memory hole. It does not exist. The New York Times, which has a special responsibility, remember, it's the newspaper of record. It creates history. History is what's in the New York Times archives, you know, not what's in the, you know, the San Francisco Herald Examiner archives. That's not where historians go. They even have archives. So therefore, the San Francisco Herald Examiner is able to print these facts, but the New York Times has a much heavier responsibility on its shoulders, and it won't even print them or even allow letters to appear which refer to them. So, for example, repeatedly, for pick one case, in April, May 1984, when Arafat was running around Europe and Asia making very public statements calling for negotiations leading to mutual recognition, the Times refused to print, to report the facts, and refused to print letters referring to it. And there's even somebody who has a letter from the foreign editor of the Times explaining why his letter is not being published. That ban on admitting those facts continued in the New York Times until March 1988, when the first hint was allowed. Come back to that. Anyhow, throughout these years, more and more proposals or initiatives recall that this is just the world of reality and therefore it's irrelevant. In the world of necessary illusion, nothing happened except Sadat in 1977 and maybe Arafat in December 1988, if you can take them seriously. Well, let's turn to the United States now, keeping to the world of irrelevant reality. In 1969, December 1969, Secretary of State William Rogers proposed the Rogers Plan, which was official U.S. policy. And it was very much like the Sadat proposal, in fact, virtually identical with the February 71 Sadat proposal that I just mentioned. As I said, Kissinger, who was then National Security Advisor, was opposed. He was in favor of stalemate, maintaining things the way they were. There was a kind of a logic behind it. The logic was the Nixon Doctrine. Israel's what Secretary of Defense Laird called a cop on the beat, a local cop on the beat to represent U.S. interests in the region. It was becoming a U.S. client state worldwide. There was a kind of logic. Israel was what's called a strategic asset, therefore we keep things the way they are. Furthermore, it was assumed that there was no big problem with the Arabs. Intelligence, in one of its quite standard, in fact near uniform, colossal failures, assumed that the Arabs couldn't figure out which end of the gun to hold. War is not the Arabs' game, as the head of Israeli military intelligence put it, Yehoshafat Harkabi, then a big hawk, now a big dove, because he changed his tactical assessments. And on that assumption, that war is not the Arabs' game, it didn't really matter much what kind of bluster they carried out. I mean, they could maneuver in the Sinai if they wanted and do all that stuff, but you didn't have to take it seriously. Henry Kissinger was being bombarded with reports from the U.S. ambassadors in the field and from the American oil companies and so on, explaining that his refusal, rejection of any diplomatic options was going to lead to war. He said, so that's just going to be forced to go to war, but everybody laughed, because war is not the Arab game. Well, along came the 1973 war. And surprisingly, war was the Arab's game. In fact, it was a very serious affair. And the United States understands that. States do understand violence. Maybe not much else, but they certainly understand violence and the efficacy of violence. And you could see that Israel's capacity to dominate the region by force was not so clear. Egypt had to be taken seriously. As a result, U.S. policy adjusted. In 1973, U.S. and it adjusted to the obvious fallback position. Since Egypt wasn't just a basket case and couldn't be ignored, we should therefore take it seriously. We should accept Sadat's long-standing offers to turn Egypt into a U.S. client state, and we should exclude Egypt from the conflict. Egypt is the major Arab military force, the major Arab deterrent. If we can exclude it from the conflict, then Israel is free with mounting U.S. support to move to integrate the occupied territories and to attack its northern neighbor. That's Camp David. The meaning of what happened from 1973 to 1978 is precisely that. Its efforts to exclude Egypt from the conflict so that Israel is then free to do exactly those things. That was obvious at the time, I should say, and it's now conceded in retrospect that that's what happened. But what else could happen? I mean, it's just in the logic of the situation. If you think about it, it's plain. I presume that when the secret documents are declassified in 20, 30 years, we'll see that people were thinking about it anyway, even if they weren't perfectly transparent that that was the logic of the situation. As I say, it's now accepted. Then comes, I don't have to bother with the details. If you know anything about the record, you'll know just what happened. U.S. support for Israel shot up, reached about 50% of total world aid in the late Carter, early Reagan period. Israeli attacks on Lebanon increased. There was an invasion in 1978. There was an extension of the heavy bombardment in 1979 and 80, finally an outright invasion in 82. The United States supported that invasion. The Republicans supported it enthusiastically. The Democrats supported it ecstatically. There was almost total support for what the New York Times called the liberation of Lebanon at the time. But the consequences were not what was expected. First, Israel failed on the ground militarily. Very crucial fact, which the Israeli military is well aware of. They were unable to displace the Syrian army from fixed positions. They won the technological war. They didn't win the ground war, and they know it. They couldn't pierce the Beirut-Damascus highway for weeks. Very well aware of that. They were unable to establish what Defense Minister Sharon called the new order in Lebanon. And in the subsequent period, they were actually driven out of much of southern Lebanon by quite unanticipated local resistance. The cost just got too high, and they had to pull out of everything except what they call their security zone. Well, again, states understand violence, and the United States adjusted once again. It was, however, assumed that at least the occupied territories could be controlled by force. Maybe war wasn't the Arabs' game, and maybe those crazy Shiites in Lebanon do all sorts of weird things, but we don't have to worry about the people in the occupied territories. Resistance still isn't their game. That was the assumption. Well, December 1987 came along. Let me incidentally go back to why Sadat's offer in 1977 can enter history. See, in 1977, Sadat could be a man of peace because U.S. policy had changed. Since U.S. policy had changed, it was possible to recognize, since we're trying to exclude Egypt from the conflict, it's possible to recognize that Sadat is offering to be excluded from the conflict. Therefore, Sadat became a man of peace. On the other hand, before U.S. policy had changed in 1971, he couldn't be making those proposals because the United States is objecting to them. So therefore, he didn't make them. That's the reason why the official story is his trip to Jerusalem was when he made himself a man of peace. Well, coming back to 1987, then we get, in December, the Intifada. And over the next couple of months, we get rising violence and repressing it, but failure. The violence is, making life very miserable for people and very brutal, and I don't have to tell you about that, but it hasn't succeeded in putting it down. So there's got to be a policy adjustment, or at least the beginnings of a policy adjustment. And along with the beginnings of policy adjustment, come an opening in the free press. So now, by early 1988, it begins to be possible to concede that the Palestinians are making various kinds of offers. In fact, the kind they've been making since January 76. And as I say, in March 1988, the New York Times finally allowed a little peek at it. Well, through 1988, all of this continues. The violence is failing to stop the uprising. Therefore, there's more and more openings. The diplomatic efforts were also becoming more insistent. In November 1988, the Palestinian National Council met in Algiers, and the PNC did propose something new. Namely, they declared a Palestinian state. That's what they called the crowning achievement of the meeting. However, that's totally unacceptable to the United States, so therefore it's off the media agenda. That's not discussed. They were also willing to discuss some modalities for achieving it, and that begins to relate to U.S. government interests, so therefore that's allowed to be on the agenda. And there's some recognition that those things are going on, though inadequate. Arafat went to Stockholm and repeated the same points, still inadequate. He was then going to come to Geneva, to New York, to speak at the U.N. General Assembly meeting. The State Department refused. Incidentally, there was virtually unanimous approval of this, except on technical grounds. Everyone agreed that the PLO had not said the magic words. All the way up to Anthony Lewis. Still the old Arafat hedge, not saying it yet. You got to be harsher. The refusal to allow the UN to meet in Geneva was flatly illegal, caused a big uproar around the world. The UN met in Geneva, where Arafat repeated what he had been saying all along. The United States still rejected it. That carries us up to December 14th. By this point, the United States was in a totally untenable position. The U.S. government position was being very broadly supported at home, in fact, virtually unanimously, but the United States government was becoming an object of international ridicule. You can't control the world as easily as you can control the free press and the intellectual community. It was becoming an object of international ridicule. Not only was, first of all, because of the refusal to allow Arafat to speak in New York, recall the reason given. The reason was it would be a security threat to the United States. It's interesting that everybody accepted that. Nobody asked, what's he going to do? I mean, is he going to hijack a taxi cab or, take over the Pentagon? I mean, exactly what's the security threat? But the point is, nothing is too absurd to be accepted if it satisfies needs. However, outside the United States, you can't get away with that so easily. The State Department was in an untenable position. Therefore, they made the natural move of any great power, especially a super, the dominant world superpower, the one that controls the world information system. They simply decided to announce that Arafat had capitulated and accepted Arab terms. That was the only way out. Then comes the delaying action, which I described. Now, final factual question to look at is, what happened on December 14th at the famous press conference? Well, it's very clear. As I say, it'll take you 2 minutes to figure it out if you bother to check. The State Department had articulated three explicit demands. And they were in writing, in words. You read them in the New York Times and the Washington Post in verbatim. It said, these words must be stated verbatim, without qualification. Those are the magic words. And the three things were, one, acceptance of UN 242, without qualifications. Two, acceptance of Israel's right to exist. And the government insisted that that was the crucial one. In fact, National Security Advisor Powell actually went on television, or at least in the newspaper, and said, that's the crucial one. You got to repeat that. And the third was rejection of terrorism. That was the word. Rejection of terrorism without qualifications. And Arafat still, as of December 13th, had not met those three demands. And again, the whole American press, virtually, one exception that I saw was, in fact, a column by William Raspberry in the Washington Post. But that apart, I couldn't find one exception, including Anthony Lewis and everyone else, to saying, still the old Arafat hedge, he's got to accept these three positions. Well, let's look into them. First, accept UN 242 without qualifications. What's the qualification? The qualification, the PLO has accepted UN 242 for years. In fact, it endorsed it, as I said already, in January 1976, 13 years earlier, in the very words of UN 242, but it had always added a qualification. The qualification was it called for those UN resolutions which talk about the right of national self-determination of Palestinians. That is, in effect, called for a Palestinian state, as explicitly in January 76. And that qualification is unacceptable. What did Arafat say in Geneva? He repeated UN 242 with the same qualification, explicitly. He said, we accept the right of all states in the region to live in peace, including the new state of Palestine and Israel. Same qualification. In fact, it's a less clear endorsement of UN 242 than in January 76, because then the PLO supported the actual wording of 242, whereas here he just paraphrased it. So the first claim that Arafat said the magic words on that one is just flat false. What about the right to exist? Nothing there. Arafat did not endorse Israel's abstract right to exist, and that's an interesting proposal. The phrase right to exist was invented by Henry Kissinger in 1975 in an effort to block the danger of a political settlement, and because he knew perfectly well that nobody's ever going to accept the abstract right to exist of Israel or any other state. There's no such concept in international affairs. The United States does not accept the abstract right of the Soviet Union to exist. In fact, we celebrate Captive Nations Week every year to say that. Secret documents talk about dismembering the Soviet Union and so on. I presume that Mexico does not accept the abstract right of the United States to exist within its current borders that include half of Mexico and so on. There is no such notion as right to exist. It doesn't exist. What there is the right to live in peace and security. That is the right to be free of terrorism and aggression. So we endorse that in the case of the Soviet Union. If the PLO were to endorse Israel's right to exist, it would be not only accepting the existence of Israel, but accepting the legitimacy of everything that had ever happened to the Palestinians, and they're not likely to do that, nor should they. That would be something unique in world affairs. That's why the term was invented, and contrary to what everything you read says, if you look at Arafat's statements, he did not accept it. The phrase he presented was right to exist in peace and security. But that's just a paraphrase of 242. That's just a repetition of the old story. What about the third point, the rejection of terrorism in all its forms? Well, in many ways, that's the most interesting of the three, and that's one that really tells you something about the importance of a well-controlled press. Arafat and the PLO had repeatedly rejected terrorism in all its forms over the years. In fact, they had repeatedly, and once again in November in Algiers, endorsed the UN resolutions on terrorism, paraphrasing them and saying they endorsed them. But the United States doesn't accept that. And again, this is across the board. I'm now talking all the way up to the critics, like, say, Anthony Lewis and so on. It's still the old Arafat hedge. So what's the old Arafat hedge on terrorism? Well, here comes a fact which you have to look at the documents to discover, because they won't print it in the newspapers. What's the hedge? Well, the UN resolutions on terrorism are accepted virtually by the entire world. The last vote at the United Nations was 153-2 with one abstention. The abstention was Honduras. The two were the United States and Israel, and South Africa also opposes it if they, because they're what is at stake if they voted, if they don't. So there's the entire world, you know, all of NATO, all the allies, and so on. And the United States is off the spectrum. What's the issue? Well, the issue is a paragraph in the resolutions which say, nothing in this resolution shall prejudice the rights of people to struggle for self-determination against racist and colonialist regimes and foreign occupation. That's the paragraph. Well, South Africa and the United States are opposed. So therefore, the entire American press is opposed, including all the liberals. And in fact, until Arafat joins us and South Africa off the spectrum of world opinion, it's just the old Arafat hedge again, and plainly you can't have that. He's weaseling out of it again. That's the position of American liberalism, remember. That's the general position when you bother to disentangle all of this and see what's at stake. Now, of course, nobody's going to tell you that. Like, there won't be an editorial on the New York Times about it, and there won't be an op-ed in the Washington Post about it. But if you take the trouble to look at the documents, you'll notice that's precisely what's at stake. And in that point, too, the third point, too, Arafat repeated the old Arafat hedge. They were not going to give up the right to resist occupation. So where we stood on December 14th is exactly where we stood on December 13th, which is, I presume, why the reporters didn't bother reporting anything, if my story is correct, if what I heard is correct. But the facts are plain. George Shultz, however, announced that the facts are the opposite of what they are, and that's all it takes. So from then on, all we read about is the seismic change of attitude, the stunning achievement, Arafat accepted our terms, the magic words, and notice that the issues are substantive. If Arafat had indeed accepted the U.S. position, he would have abandoned the right of national self-determination, that is the qualification to 242. He would have accepted the legitimacy of everything that's happened to the Palestinians, not just the fact of it. That's the second point, the right to exist. And he would have renounced the right to support people in a liberated village who throw stones when the Israeli army comes in to try to smash up the popular committees. He would have renounced that right. Plainly, he didn't do that. And if he had done that, he would have abandoned everything, which is why the United States claims that he did it. Well, then comes the delaying action that Yitzhak Rabin is happy about. Now, if Rabin is right, we'll turn to the tactical judgment. If Rabin is correct, there will be a return to the prior status quo with U.S. support and media support. That is, if it's possible by harsh economic measures to put down the Intifada, harsh military and economic measures. Suppose that the peace now skeptics are correct, and it won't be possible to put it down by violence and pressure, well, then there's going to be another adjustment of U.S. policy. We'll show ourselves to be a kindler, gentler nation, and we'll adjust to the new realities exactly as in the earlier cases, 1973 and 1982. And all of this will have media applause. That's guaranteed either way, as the record quite amply demonstrates. Well, notice, finally, that what U.S. citizens decide to do, if they decide to do anything at all, could make quite a large difference. However, is another topic, an important one. On this topic, on the present topic, if you take a look at the record and you check the accuracy of what I've just sketched out, as I again very much urge that you do, you'll find it illuminating, I think what you'll find is a very dramatic example extending now over 20 years of how necessary illusions can be crafted and of the terrible human consequences that can ensue.